The book of Job is a really fascinating book of the Bible. Now, to begin with, as mentioned, following the book of Nehemiah, most of the books that follow out in sequence, though are placed in a chronological order in regards to the Bible, are not necessarily laid out in canon or the compilation of the Old Testament in order. And so, when we address any of these books, beginning last week with Esther, continuing this week with the book of Job, one of the first things that we're going to do before we get into any of the nitty-gritty of what the book actually talks about, I figure that it would be important, at least helpful, especially if we're trying to put everything together in this crazy puzzle piece, these 66 books, they all make up the Bible, of where it fits in back in the narrative, the history. From Genesis to the end, Nehemiah chapter 13, we get the history of the Jews. The next historical event to occur within the nation, the people of God, following Nehemiah 13, is the arrival of John the Baptist. And so all of these other books place themselves back in chronological or timetable within Genesis to Nehemiah. Now, the book of Job is difficult. It's difficult to pinpoint when it was written because it's difficult to pinpoint who wrote it. Now, there are a few theories in regards to who wrote the book of Job. A lot of people conclude that the book of Job is actually the very first book of the Bible ever written. That the book of Job, at least when it was penned, was written before the book of Genesis. Now, one theory is that Moses, as a matter of fact, if there was a consensus at all in regards to who wrote Job, it would be Moses. And that Moses either wrote the book of Job, recording this guy and his life and the story of his life, before he wrote the Pentateuch or the first five books of the Bible, or sometime after. The theory is that the land of Uz, which is where Job dwelt, was more than likely in the land, the regions of Midian. And we know that Moses, when he fled out of Egypt, spent 40 years of his life where? In Midian. Not only that, but Midian was one of the sons of Abraham through one of his concubines. And so the Midianites were monotheistic. A lot of the oral traditions that Abraham had taught his children of earlier events were passed down. Jethro and that whole family line had lineage, a link, back to Abraham. And so one of the theories is that Moses, during this time period in the regions of Midian, learned about Job, learned about his story, and recorded it down. Another theory is that Moses had no role at all in the authorship, and one of the characters towards the end of the book, a guy named Elihu, actually wrote it. The evidence for that is that when you get to Elihu's character and his dialogue with Job, in a weird way, it flips into the first person. And so possibly Elihu, this guy dating back before Moses, one of the characters that was intimately involved with the story, writes this all down. He's recording the conversations. He's recording the events. And then he gets to a point where he interjects himself, dialogue, into the text. Just a theory. There's another theory that Job himself wrote this. Regardless, there is one thing we know for certain, and that's God wrote the book of Job. Now, in regards to a timetable or placing the story of Job into Scripture, you could place the story of Job as early as pre-flood. And I think that's an extreme interpretation, that's an extreme application. Most people would place Job as a contemporary of one of the patriarchs. That Job lived during the same time period as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. More than likely, probably leaning more towards the time period of Jacob. Regardless, chapter 1, though, introduces Job as a guy who had an incredible relationship with God. He had a walk with God. He had interactions with God. We're told that he was blameless, and he offered sacrifices before God. And so we know up front that regardless of when you place this book and where you place this book and who wrote this book, we do know that Job loved God. the true God, the God of Abraham. Now, whether or not this book was the first book written, or rather it was a later book written, either way, that's really a secondary point in the bigger picture of what the content of the story of Job serves to address. Because the content, or really the ultimate question that this story tries to address and does address, is timeless. Back following the flood, before the flood even, with the fall, there's always been a question that has been debated, a question that has been controversial, that has existed whether it was religious scholars or whether it was pagan philosophers. There has been a topic that is as old as dirt. And that topic is really the problem that exists between pain and suffering and its coexistence with an all-loving God. Now, this is still a common question asked and posed by many people today. I can't tell you how many times in dealing with a group of students or in conversations I might have that this question always gets posed. How can an all-loving God exist if there's evil? You see, atheists or agnostics, skeptics, try to use the existence of pain and suffering as a proof to the fact that an all-loving God couldn't exist. And really, this attaches itself to our heartstrings. Because these are things, these are questions that even as followers of God, we still intellectually have to battle with. Why? Because emotionally, we're attached. And what do I mean by that? I don't know if you've ever allowed this thought process to pass through your brain. I have. But when something bad happens, when something goes down, whether it's a boyfriend or a girlfriend breaks up with you, whether it's something more extreme like an illness, whether it's your parents getting divorced, or you getting attacked or abused in some way, verbally or physically, whenever something bad or something that we would classify as evil or we would at least attribute to producing pain and suffering, our initial reaction is typically, God, why in the world would you allow these things to happen to me if you love me? It's a common question posed by someone that has been a victim of rape or abuse. But aside from all those things, poverty, people that starved to death, wars, innocence being taken advantage of. Have you ever thought about those issues? How can God really exist, though? And these things exist. Religious scholars have discussed this and debated it. Pagan philosophers, from Aristotle to Socrates to Plato, down through the millennia, have all talked about this particular issue. Now, what's fascinating is the book of Job addresses this very question. The book of Job, the main point of the book of Job, is addressing the basic question of human suffering and it coexisting with an all-loving God. Can the two coexist, and what are the logical questions and reasonings that exist in regards to this overarching conversation? Now, before we look at the book of Job, before your minds wander any farther with the questions that I pose, let me give you a biblical defense to that core question. Because you'll get asked it. People will state it. And people will challenge your faith based upon it. How can an all-loving God exist if evil exists? There was a gentleman, his name was Charles Templeton, and he was an integral member of the Billy Graham Crusade. He was one of the founding members of the Billy Graham Crusade, was involved as a core member. People looked to him as leaders for leadership. People looked to him for spiritual guidance. He was a born-again believer that God was using in amazing ways. And then he saw a Time magazine article. The front cover had a poor Ethiopian kid in Africa, bloated, starving to death, was dying of diseases that could be easily treated, but wouldn't, and he would die. And Charles Templeton was so struck by that, that he rejected his faith on the conclusion that that was a proof that an all-loving God couldn't exist, because how could God be all-loving and allow that to happen? And he totally walked away from his faith. As a matter of fact, in The Case for Christ, Lee Strobel's book, dealing with some apologetical issues, he references this story of Charles Templeton as an example, even later on, having an interview with Charles Templeton himself. Now, an easy explanation for that question, how can an all-loving God exist with evil? Now, please understand that the question itself actually refutes itself. And this is what I mean. The question, how can an all-loving God allow evil to exist, is self-refuting. Because the first question is, okay, there's evil. That's an undeniable fact of life. It's something that we all understand and we all have an idea concerning. So evil exists. But the question is how do we know something's evil? Like, how can we actually make that statement? How can we state that evil exists? Well, because good exists. And how do we know that good exists? And thus to determine that there's evil? Well, there is a standard by which good and evil is based upon. Now, everyone understands that there are certain things that are wrong and there are certain things that are right. There are certain things that are evil and there are certain things that are good. Every one of you in this room, if I took a little baby, plucked out its eyes, poured gasoline on it, and lit it on fire, would say, that's bad. That's evil. That's disturbing. And I use a drastic example to state not one person in this room would not conclude that that was evil. But how can you say that it's evil? You see, the reality is, in order for you to make decisions based upon what is good and what is evil, there has to be a standard. There has to be moral law. You see, if there's good, the only way we know there's good, there's evil. The only way we know there's evil is there's good. The only way that we know that there's good to differentiate between evil is that there is a giver of good. There's a standard of good. That there's moral law. A right and a wrong. Now here's the interesting thing. If there is a moral law, in order for a moral law to exist, it has to be provided by a moral law giver. Who, interestingly enough, can't be finite, can't be temporal, and has to be, by definition, infinite or outside of things. And this presence that exists outside of things sets the standard for what is good and bad. Thus, I can say there's evil, and I can say there's good. And guess, by the way, who that person is? God. So to say God can't exist because I see evil refutes itself. The very fact you see evil, by the way, is a proof that God does exist. But then let's get more specific. Loving God? Now, we have a misconception about what that means. Because I would pose the reverse. How can God really love without providing man the opportunity for evil? You see, if God determined everyone's behavior, then you could say that, well, this is messed up. Because then it's God making people do evil, perverted, horrible things. Or, in God's love, he provides people the opportunity or the freedom to make choices. Some of them good and others of them evil. But the very fact that God is loving is the fact that we're not robotic and we have the freedom of choice. You see, understand that there are practical answers to these kind of questions. At the same time, I would never, in any case, advise that someone in the midst of suffering, you say, buck up, boy, and here's my apologetical reason. Why? Because they're not experiencing something necessarily on an intellectual plane. They're suffering. This is something about the heart. This is something they're experiencing emotionally and physically. Now, Job opens, and it continues. The book itself provides some things that we need to think about in regards to suffering and pain. Now, understand up front, the book of Job doesn't provide the answer to this question about suffering. But it does challenge some concepts in regards to things we should think about and keep in mind as we approach this topic. Now, to begin with, the book of Job opens. There's like this first scene. And you can read the book of Job in regards to kind of almost Shakespearean in some regards. It is poetic. It is the first of the poetic books of Scripture. And this dialogue plays itself out like a drama. It opens with the first scene. And within the first scene, the first three chapters, we're given a really interesting detail into what's going to happen. Job's introduced as a good guy, a blameless guy, a righteous guy before God. Good guy. Satan then goes before the throne room of God. And he's having this conversation with God. And God's like, oh, by the way, Job, have you seen my man? Satan, have you seen how blameless he is? Have you seen how righteous he is? Have you seen how he's dedicated to me and obedient to me? God starts bragging to Satan about Job, which is pretty cool. God, A, was intimately involved in the life of Job enough to know what was going on. He's the same with you. But beyond that, he brags about his kids. Every dad brags about their kids. And so God's bragging about Job. And Satan is like, well, God, here's the problem. The problem is that, you know, Job is obedient and he's faithful primarily because the guy's never had any problems. You see, Job was a wealthy guy. He was a prosperous guy. He was a powerful guy. He had fame and notoriety in the land. And Satan's like, of course he's going to be obedient to you. Life is good. Here's the challenge. Allow me to mess some things up in the life of Job, and then he'll curse you because life is no longer good. So Satan seeks permission from God to apply a little pain and suffering in the life of Job. And God says, okay, go for it. But here's the deal. You can't mess with his health. So in one day, all of Job's kids are killed. All of them. And at the same time, all of his wealth, which was counted in cattle, he was a herdsman, they all died as well. And in one day, Job lost all of his money, all of his finances, all of his house, his 401k, his pension, everything that Job had in regards to monetary things, he lost. And not only that, but all of his children dies, but he loses his family. And only his wife survives, who, if you read the story, was kind of more of a curse than a blessing because she's nagging. And she's like, at some point, Job, curse God and die. Great advice from a loving wife. Like, and so here to begin with, we see that Job, who's a blameless man, incurs great hardship, suffering, pain, immense pain. But he doesn't curse God, and he's obedient, and he remains faithful and blameless. Now, Satan goes back to God. And God's like, I told you, my man Job. And Satan's like, yeah, well, if you give me authority to mess with his health, surely he'll curse you. So God's like, go for it. And so Job breaks out in these horrible boils. And he can get no relief. He bed sores. He can't lay down. He can't sit. He can't walk. He can't move. He's so miserable. He's lost everything. He's lost all of his kids. He's got boils all over his body. And we're told that he sits down in the city dump and he takes broken pieces of pottery and he's just scratching himself. I mean, this is like chicken pox on steroids, what Job is having to endure. And then in chapter 3, we're given a glimpse into his despair, because Job, though he doesn't curse God and remains blameless and righteous, he does wish he had been dead or that he had never been born. Total agony existing in Job. Now, in this first scene, we pick up three key components to this whole topic about pain and suffering. First, the Bible is honest in regards to the reality of suffering. And that might seem very simplistic, but I want you to understand this. The Bible doesn't sugarcoat life. It doesn't make false promises that it doesn't hold true to. The Bible is honest in regards to the human condition as produced by sin. And the Bible is very honest in regards to the condition of the world as produced by sin. And not only that, but Jesus was equally honest about what it meant to truly follow him, right? Jesus doesn't sugarcoat that. Following me doesn't mean that life is grand or great. As a matter of fact, it means that life probably will be harder for you, not better. If they killed your leader, you think they're going to just play patty cake with you. Like, they're going to persecute you. And the Bible, from Genesis chapter 3, all the way through the book of Revelation, is honest about the reality of suffering. It's there. It's undeniable. And it stings everyone. Everyone suffers. Everyone endures pain. Everyone has hardship. It is a pivotal, integral part of the human condition. And the Bible's honest about this. The book of Job is honest about this. But secondly, we're told what the source of all suffering is. Please understand, the source of suffering, the source of Job's suffering, was not God. Whose imagination developed the plot of Job? Was this God's imagination? Was this God's plan in the sense that God was the one scheming on how he was going to smack down Job and make Job's life miserable? No. We're told in the Bible that God's thoughts towards you are thoughts of peace, not of evil, to give you a future and a hope. Satan, on the flip side to it, his thoughts are not thoughts of peace or hope. Satan's thoughts towards you are very specific. He wants to rape, kill, and destroy. Satan's plan for you is to destroy you. The Bible describes him as a lion seeking in whom he may devour. Satan wants to rip you off, to rip you down, to turn you in, to make you miserable. See, it was Satan that proposed this suffering for Job. Now, one of the other things that we learn, Job being an example of this, please understand that good people are not immune to suffering. Now, we're told up front, right, that Job was a blameless guy. Read chapter 1. If that wasn't any more evident, God's bragging about what? Job's righteousness. So if there was any question of, well, maybe there was something that no one really knew about, God knows everything, and God is bragging about Job. So Job is not being punished. You see, good people endure suffering. Bad people endure suffering. Everyone endures suffering. And the reality, the tough reality, is that God plays a role and suffering. You see, the reality of our story is that though the source of pain was Satan, God nonetheless allowed it. Now, that's where we get down to those tough pills to swallow concerning pain and suffering. Because God allows me to endure these things? Yes. The book of Job doesn't sugarcoat that. But also note that God, in addition to allowing it, dictates the parameters. Do you notice that within our story? Satan wants to do certain things to Job. God allows them to happen, but he dictates the parameters by which Satan has authority. Now, you know, we often get just bogus idea about God and Satan. And we somehow get this idea that they're dueling forces. Good versus evil. God versus Satan, right? Angels versus demons. Jesus popping up on one shoulder talking. Satan popping up on the other shoulder talking. Like somehow, Jesus and Satan are almost equals duking it out. What this story tells us is that is as far from the truth as possible. Satan can't do anything without getting God's permission. Satan's very enemy is God. But Satan can't do anything without getting God's permission. And though Satan is the source of suffering, and though God allows Satan to interject suffering in our lives, the reality is that God also, though, dictates how that suffering can be applied, how long it should be applied, and the parameters by which it should be applied. That God has a role. But his role is very specific. And ultimately, there's always a purpose behind suffering, right? You see, we see this in our story, even in the first scene. God is bragging about Job. And we know that this was a test that Job would have to endure. That Job was on trial before God. And God was defending Job. And that how Job handled his suffering had a much bigger role than Job simply knew. You see, the interesting thing about the book of Job is that Job, at least in the story, had never read the first three chapters. Job was unaware of this scene that had developed and played itself out in the heaven. From Job's perspective, these things were happening to him on accident. That he was suffering, and he couldn't make a rhyme or reason as a result to it. But we know Satan's the source. Suffering happens to everyone. Good people aren't immune. God dictates the parameters. But God always has a plan. And there's always a greater purpose behind our suffering. Something to think about. But then the Bible's equally clear. And this is the third point in this first scene. Is that the Bible's clear in regards to the results of suffering. Now, oftentimes, you'll read Bible commentators place chapters 1 and 2 in their section, chapter 3 through 37 in another. I don't claim to know much, but I decided to put chapter 3 in this first scene because it's really Job just crying out. And does God rebuke Job for crying out? No. And there's tears, and there's hurt, and there's pain. And there's honest anguish, emotionally, physically, spiritually. But does God come down on Job for hurting? Not at all. Now, this is one of those things that irritates me about Christians. Because somehow we look down upon people that are honestly hurting and are honest about it. It's almost as though, yeah, your life's miserable, but it shouldn't be miserable when you come to church. You should be happy, and you should put on that face. But the Bible's honest that it's okay to reflect the way that you feel. And Job was hurting, and Job was grieving, and Job was in pain. And chapter 3 records just the honest cry of his heart. And that's okay. You see, in addition to making it clear of the reality of suffering and the source of suffering, the story of Job equally illustrates the result of suffering. Now you get to the second scene, and it's basically this conversation that ensues. Chapters 4 through 37 records four conversations that happen. There are three guys that come to comfort a suffering Job. These are his friends. These three friends, their names are Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophah. And they come, here's Job in the junkyard, scratching his boils, pain, suffering. He's cried out in anguish. And they come to give him words of encouragement. Miserable comforters are these three. As a matter of fact, that's Job in chapter 16, making it clear that these three guys were morons. They did more harm than good. And Job was like, you were a lot better when you just shut up. The more you talk, the worse of a comforter you were. Because these guys decide that it's time to have a theological discussion of pain and suffering. This is kind of like the midnight banter. Friends at Waffle House with multiple cups of coffee, talking theology that can go into the wee hours of the night, whose wives get irritated because it's the wee hours of the night and want to go home because they really don't like Waffle House to begin with. I don't know. Maybe I'm speaking from personal experience. Either way, here we find these three guys coming to Job, and they decide they're going to have this conversation. Now, the stupid part is that each of these guys basically says the same thing. And then with each of their dialogues, Job responds kind of the same way, just from a little bit of a different angle. So three waves of conversations from these guys, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophah. With each of these statements made by his buddies, Job refutes it and gives a defense. Now, all three of these guys basically pose this question. Like, this is where this conversation whittles itself down into a nutshell. Is human suffering always divine punishment? You see, the logic of these three guys is Job. Clearly, the only reason all of this stuff would have happened to you is the fact that God's punishing you. Like, that's the only logical reason we can come up with why God would allow all of these things to happen. It's because God just doesn't like you because you've been sinning. You're wicked. You're doing something wrong. And each time this is stated, Job goes on the record saying, no, I maintain my integrity. I maintain my character. I maintain my innocence. I have done nothing wrong. Now, we know Job has done nothing wrong, right? Why? Because the Bible, this story, has already made it clear that he was blameless. And so Job is right in his defense of like, listen, that can't make sense because I'm telling you, I haven't sinned. I'm not bringing this upon myself. But in certain instances, Job also presents another flaw to basic human reasoning. That flaw is this. Okay, let's say that human pain and human suffering are the byproduct or the result of sin, that it's God's punishment. Then there's a problem with that, because wait a second, why do we see wicked, evil people not get punished? Why do we see in our world good people suffer and bad people prosper? Hugh Hefner is a wicked dude. That guy has done more through Playboy magazine to corrupt the mind of the men of our culture than maybe anything else in the last 40 years. He's wicked and perverted. But is the guy suffering? No. He's got like 30 beautiful blondes wearing very little clothing, running around his house all of the time, and the guy gets to live in his nighttime clothes. Like, the guy lives and sweats. Like, that's not suffering. That's awesome. Like, nobody rips on Hugh Hefner for wearing his nighttime outfit when he goes out on the town. Why? He's Hugh Hefner. He can do what he wants. Wicked guy, really prospering. So wait a second. If suffering is God punishing people for their sin, But we see open sinners not being punished. I have a problem with that. And that's one of the things that Job says. That's one of the flaws to this logic. But then there's another one. Like, wait a second. If suffering and pain is God punishing sin and wickedness, then what about the good people that get caught in the crosshairs? Like, recently we have an example of this. Pat Robertson said something that was totally moronic with this Haiti earthquake. Now, I understand what he was saying. He was referencing some of the, you know, the history of Haiti and their slave rebellion and their constitution and the theory that they dedicated the island to Satan. But he said that this is divine punishment, this earthquake, because of all the voodoo and the wickedness and all that stuff. Now, wait a second. Guess who else died? Christians, missionaries, churches were wiped flat. And if I remember correctly, God promised not to judge the righteous with the wicked, the just with the unjust. So that can't make sense either. And if that was the logic, then why in the world has Las Vegas not experienced an earthquake? Isn't it just as sinful? And it's Sin City, for Pete's sake. It's the name tag. Why isn't it destroyed? You see, understand that this concept is the best that religion can present. And I did say religion. Because this is basically a core concept of all of the world's religions, with the exception of genuine followers of Jesus. It's just the reverse to it. You see, religion teaches that I earn God's favor by my good deeds. That I'm working to earn God's favor. I'm working to earn salvation. Now, the flip side to that is if I'm doing bad things, I'm losing God's favor and encouraging and encountering God's judgment. You see, this idea of human suffering being a byproduct of sin is the reverse of human blessing being a byproduct of personal holiness. Both are fundamentally wrong. And so here they are, and they start talking about the limitations of human explanations. You know, as mentioned before, atheists love to come to Christians and say, how can an all-loving God exist when there's evil in the world? Don't feel always on the defense. The flip side, it's okay, Mr. Atheist. What do you have to give the sufferer? Like, what kind of comfort can you provide the woman who's been raped? I'm sorry, ma'am. You know, we're all a byproduct of human evolution and total random chance. And, you know, it's survival of the fittest. And I'm sorry, you just apparently weren't fit enough because you couldn't defend yourself. This is Darwinian's way of weeding you out. And I'm so sorry that this happened to you. That's tragic. But we're all human instincts and we can just take what we want. Like, that's crazy. And nor would anyone, by the way, provide that kind of solace to a sufferer. But that's logically consistent. Suffering exists. The Christian point of view, though, says that Satan is the originator of that suffering. That God allows that suffering for a greater divine purpose. And that God will never allow anything to come your way without first being filtered through his love and his grace, and won't allow anything to come your way beyond what you can handle. Like, these are all promises that God has given. And so we see a flaw in human explanations. Now, there is another conversation that exists with this guy, Eliyahu. Kind of, he's listening to these three other guys. Job's going back and forth with them. And Eliyahu's finally like, I've had enough. He's just been overhearing it all. And he interjects. Now, he says some good things. He says some things that are kind of questionable. And in a lot of ways, he kind of nails it in some regard. Because he challenges Job to begin to think about some things that God, who's about to weigh in, will hammer home. He says, like, Job, first, like, be careful. Because you're really not that righteous. I mean, we've all sinned. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. Job is included. And though he was a good man and he was blameless before God, that didn't make him perfect before God. He wasn't. And so Elihu's like, you need to be a little careful. You're saying some things, you're making some claims that are starting to be borderline. But also, this conversation I've been overhearing is great and all, but you need to keep in mind that God is just. And that the flip side to this all is that he does punish the wicked. There are practical examples that we see that, Sodom and Gomorrah. God wiped out the wicked. The armies of Pharaoh, God destroyed the wicked. The Canaanites and the Amorites, God destroyed the wicked. The inhabitants of Jericho, God destroyed the wicked. There are plenty of examples, because God is just, that God has to deal with sin. And that's often pain and suffering. Ultimately, hell is a place of pain and suffering. Torment. And so Elihu, he's like, I understand this conversation, but you've got to keep this in mind as well. Also, be careful not to be self-righteous, Job. That's often something that we all, if we're not careful, we could be hypocritical and we could be self-righteous and we could have a perspective of oneself that isn't attached to reality. And then finally, Elihu's like, and don't forget that God is good. That is a core characteristic, a divine characteristic of who he is, that God is good. Now you get to the third scene, because following this conversation with Elihu, God breaks his silence. It's time for God to get in on the conversation. And from chapters 38 through the end of the book, chapter 42, God starts asking some of the questions of his own. Now, this whole conversation that's existed up until this point has been all about God. And so one, at least initially, is like, all right, right on. God, it's about time for you to start answering my questions. I'm living on this planet. I'm seeing what's happening. I'm having a hard time justifying a few things. Listen, God, it's time for you to go on the record. But God doesn't exactly enter the conversation to answer questions. As a matter of fact, he comes into the conversation posing some questions. You see, he starts off by really dealing with the foolishness of finite pea-brain human beings questioning an infinite, all-knowing God. He's like, Job, where were you when I was making everything out of nothing? Like, you seem to have everything under control. Where were you when I put the sun up there and hung the stars and separated the waters? Where were you? See, God starts asking some questions. Listen, Job, you're a human being with a very small brain and a very small perspective and a very small bit of knowledge. I happen to be God, who is very big, with a very big mind, and a very big understanding, and a whole lot of knowledge. And you see, God begins to question this whole idea, the foolishness of people who don't know anything, questioning the intents of a God who knows all. God's like, wait a second. There's something kind of wrong with that. Like, not to mention, if I explained it to you, it's probably too complex for you to even know, because I'm God. I like that about God, by the way, that there's not, that I can't explain everything there is about God, right? Because if I could explain everything there was about God, he would be a really lame God, because I know very little. Yeah, I know the Trinity. I can explain it all perfectly. Like, you can, okay, cool. Like, I like the fact that there are certain things about God that I step back and say, his ways are higher than mine, and I don't grasp it all, and that's why I hit my knees in worship. And so Job's stepping back. And in response to this, by the way, he's silent. He's kind of like, I can't answer those questions, God. Like, just calls him on the carpet. And then there's a second line of questioning from God. You see, in chapter 42, he starts talking about the limited knowledge of finite humanity. And basically, the question that God poses is, what is more logical, limited human reasoning or infinite divine revelation? Now this is ultimately what's happening in our book. And this is very important. You see, Job deals with this question. Pain, suffering, all-loving God, right? God jumps in on it, provides the answer. We want a why to our pain. God's answer is not a why, but rather a who. You see, basically what God is saying is like, Job, I'm not going to answer those questions. I'm not going to give you those reasons. But rather, I'm going to draw your attention and shift your perspective off of your problem and onto me. Because though you might not understand why there's pain and suffering, you still should understand some things about pain and suffering and me. One, I love you and I care about you and I'm not going to withhold any good thing from you, and that suffering has a purpose. I'm a bodybuilder, right? I mean, I hit the iron like nobody's business. You can tell, I know. But the truth is that faith is a muscle. It's a muscle. And like any muscle, the only way it grows and it's strengthened, it first has to be broken down. It has to be strained. That's why when you work out and you're pumping the iron, I think you pump the iron like this, I'm just speculating. Like, you're sore afterwards. And you're getting to that last one and it's burning, it burns. And the guy's like, push it, man, push it, get through it. Endure, and you're like, it hurts, sorry, this stinks. And then you put that bar down, and you're like, I hurt. And you go home, and you're sore, and you're popping ibuprofen, like 12 of them. Just kidding. And you're coming home, and you're like, oh, I'm so sore. Well, you go to sleep. And what happens? Your muscles begin to heal themselves. And when they heal themselves, your muscles grow back stronger. So that what? It takes more to get that burning feeling. It takes more to tear them down, and you grow stronger. Faith is the same way. And a lot of times, God allows suffering, and he allows pain. He allows trials, testings of our faith to develop perseverance, to strengthen us. If you want to be a puny, non-impactual Christian, then pray that God preserves you from any kind of suffering. But if you want to grow, then when the suffering comes its way, you don't pray for an escape, but you pray for the strength to persevere. And then ultimately, here's the thing. Is God asking you, and is he asking me to do anything that he himself wasn't first willing to do? You see, the interesting point to be made in the debate between God and suffering is the reality that God has suffered. And we don't talk about that. Jesus came and lived, and he was tempted in all manners and all forms as we were. He was tried and true, sinless, and yet what happened? He died on the cross. Jesus suffered. And by the way, he suffered unjustly. He didn't deserve it. But that sting of life bit him too. And when Jesus says, listen, I'm not going to give you a why, but look to me, I'll help you through. And it's not about getting around this storm. It's about me jumping in the boat with you and helping you to the other side. And I understand what you're going through. And I sympathize with what you're going through. Why? Because I've gone through things. And I understand them. No other God presented in any religion has ever been presented as a sufferer who can then identify with us. And when God tells us that there are things we need to keep in mind when we're suffering, He's telling us that, not from some lofty perch looking down on humanity, giving us some truths that have never been tried out, but rather as the God who's come down into the valley, tried them out, and can say, they work. Never doubt God's goodness. Always see that God has a purpose. Know that He'll never tempt you or test you beyond what you can handle. And know there's always a purpose behind it, always a reason. That God works all things for the good for those who love Him and those who are called according to His purpose. You know who makes the best comforters? Those who have suffered and been comforted. I'm going to close with a personal story of something that brought this home to me in a most radical way. I'd been dating this girl in Bible college. Thought we were going to get married. It was going to be great. Trying to figure out exactly how it was all going to play itself out. It was towards the end of my final semester or whatnot. And she dumped me. Out of the blue. Dumped me. And I was broken. I was hurting. I was distraught. I was alone. My future seemed unclear because I was making plans kind of around her. I didn't know what to do. I was genuinely grieving. And I'll never forget, I was weeping, crying. And as anyone who's really sobbed those alligator-sized tears, right? You know, a great place to do it is the shower. Why? Because you're crying, and then it's just like the snot's rolling, and you can just shoot those snot rockets and not even worry about it. Like, that's a great place. It's a great place to cry in the shower because you don't have to worry about the whole Kleenex thing. So I was in the shower crying my little eyes out. Pathetic. Pathetic. And I was praying. I say praying. It was probably more of a totally inappropriate diatribe against God that I'm glad I didn't get struck dead for. So it wasn't so much praying, it was one-sided, me yelling in the shower as I'm crying. And we've all been there. Or will be. It'll happen and you'll be like, I'm going to the shower. That seems like a good idea at this point. But here I was, and I was talking to God, arguing with God, yelling at God. And I said, God, You don't know what I'm going through. You don't know what I'm experiencing. You don't know what it's like to really love someone and to genuinely care about someone and to invest everything into that person only to have that person reject you and leave you high and dry. You don't understand what that's like. And then I'm telling you, it was like a voice about as audible as I can get without it actually being audible. God spoke to me, and He says, oh, really, Mr. Adams? You don't think I understand what it feels like to really love someone enough to really go to the extreme to show that love, aka dying on the cross, only to then have that very person that you love so much reject you? You don't think I know what that feels like, son? I experience that every single day when someone dies rejecting that free gift of salvation I've provided. And I'm telling you, it was like I stepped back and it was one of the most powerfully sobering instances I've ever encountered. And I realized God doesn't give me a why. That's what I want. But instead, He focuses my attention on who's really in control. And that's Jesus. Bad things happen. Not going to sugarcoat it. But the reality is that God is still in control. And our job is to keep our eyes on Him.